The Obama administration has waited until now to submit its overseas contingency operations budget to Congress. That's because the president had yet to determine how many troops would stay in Afghanistan. Now the request for fiscal 2015 is $58.6 billion. Federal News Radio's DOD reporter Jared Serbu says the Pentagon's request is well below what many observers expected.
They could have gone for a higher figure, given the fact that Congress has basically rejected the administration's request for this Opportunity Security and Growth Initiative, which would have been an extra $20 billion for DOD beyond the sequestration caps. They were going to use that for several things, including to buy back readiness. So one of the things that they could have done, having seen that rejection from Congress, try to buy back some of that readiness within the OCO budget. They chose not to do that. Second interesting thing is, by this point in the year, Congress already has its own ideas about what it wants to do with OCO, and it has targeted much higher figures, $79 billion, exactly the same as the placeholder that DOD had in place. And they're using that money for many things that they don't want to give up, including weapons platforms, interestingly, including the A-10. The House voted, both in its authorization bill and in its appropriation bill a couple weeks ago, to use that money in order to save the A-10, one of the platforms that DOD believes that it needs to get rid of in order to maintain readiness and keep the rest of the force balanced.
Well, that's interesting, because usually it's the administration asking for more money than Congress sees fit. Here you have the opposite.
You do have the opposite, and this obviously needs to get reconciled with the Senate too. They're a little bit behind where the House is at this point in the year, and they have not. The Senate has not come up with a full appropriations bill yet, nor an authorization bill. The Senate Armed Services Committee has passed a DOD authorization bill, but it hasn't gone to the floor yet. In the Senate version, they do accede to some of the cost-saving measures that DOD proposed in its base budget back in March, but not many of them.
And so what's the advantage to the Defense Department of asking for $20 billion less? What is the strategy?
Well, in a way, it kind of makes sense. I think they're trying to play it safe, because there's no guarantee that there will be OCO budgets passed in the future. And another interesting thing about this submission, Emily, was DOD and the Obama White House, they made it very clear that they're going to continue to make OCO requests in the future. But there's no guarantee that Congress will pass any OCO money beyond 2015, or even in 2015. But the military service chiefs have made it very clear that even when almost everybody is out of Afghanistan, they're going to continue to need those overseas contingency operations funds in order to basically do what they call reset, which is, repairing, damaged items that were lost on the battlefield in Afghanistan, and even do some things that are not directly related to Operation Enduring Freedom. There are a couple of air bases, for example, in the Middle East that are paid for with OCO funds. So the White House has been steadily moving things out of OCO and into the base, knowing that, that OCO money is going to go away at some point. It's not clear what that point will be exactly. But again, I think they're playing it safe here, trying to get as much into the base as they can, because they know they're not going to be able to rely on OCO forever.
And has Congress seen amenable to that idea of folding whatever has to outlast the OCO budget into the major budget?
Well, they have. They've been basically pressuring the executive branch to do just that in past years. But now we have this thing called sequestration, which changes the game a little bit. They've got to stay in the base budget anyway. They've got to stay below the caps, which this year, for 2015 rather, is $496 billion. One way to spend more money on defense without changing sequestration is to move more money into OCO, because OCO is not subject to those Budget Control Act caps. So now that they're facing this pressure to stay within those BCA caps, OCO looks a little bit more attractive as a source of funding for programs that they like.
We're speaking with Federal News Radio's DOD reporter Jared Serbu. And Jared, moving from what the Pentagon wants to do with its money to how it buys things, you write on federalnewsradio.com that the Pentagon needs an acquisition system that knows how to say good enough. Is that a reference to the idea that it always wants something that is customized and perfect just for the purpose?
Yeah, basically. And, you know, that this idea of getting to 80% solutions isn't exactly a new one. But one of the interesting things in a hearing before the House Armed Services Committee that came up a few times last week, the House Armed Services Committee, by the way, is in the process of building what will take the form of some kind of acquisition reform legislation probably by next year. And this hearing was a preparatory effort for that. But one of the things that came up repeatedly was the military services are the ones driving the requirements train. The Pentagon does not have enough intellectual bandwidth in its joint functions to come up with something that makes sense for the joint force as a whole. We're still in this mode where the military services are in charge of that and are designing systems that suit their needs, raise their prestige, without doing enough consideration of what makes sense in a joint capacity. There is this thing called the Joint Requirements Oversight Council, which Congress created a few years back in order to solve that exact problem. But one of the things that we heard in this hearing from several defense experts is that there's just not enough capability within that JROC and enough authority to say no to certain requirements or say yes to things, on the other hand, that the services themselves are not particularly interested in. So Dr. Christopher Lamb was one of those experts. He's the deputy director at the National Defense University's Institute for National Strategic Studies. And he says in order to get to a place where DOD is really making well-thought-out joint decisions about procurement, you'd need to do quite a bit of restructuring in terms of human capital in the Pentagon.
I think a lot of people would say it's not politically feasible, but we made a recommendation for a system that would produce joint data for joint operational concepts with joint modeling that would help make alternatives transparent and make the consequences of one path or another much more readily accessible to senior decision makers. But you would have to redo the way the Pentagon currently does its analysis of requirements today. We don't have that much analytic talent, and we tend to reserve what analytic talent we have in the joint field to operational level campaign analysis. So there would be a lot that would have to change about the politics and the procedures for making that kind of talent available to people in a position of joint responsibility, for example.
Again, Dr. Christopher Lamb from NDU. So, you know, who knows? We may or may not see some kind of reforms to the Joint Requirements Oversight Council in the acquisition reform legislation the House eventually comes up with, again, probably sometime by next year. But there's been a broad recognition for a long time that whether it's in the joint community or whether it's in the services themselves, DOT, especially when it comes to big weapon systems, has a tendency to overspecify. Retired Vice Admiral David Vinlet, another one of the witnesses from last week. He recently left the military after having served as the program manager for the F-35. He acknowledges, too, that the requirements that program managers set can be a little too ambitious.
When we write down those requirements, we have this wonderful organization called Operational Test that tests to what we write down about those requirements. And when the performance, for various reasons, either through unfortunate choices in design or surprises or things that you discover when you reach for high capability, that report may come out and you are short of some of those very tall requirements. We get pretty agitated when we believe we can't abide those, and we need you need somebody to be what I would call the chief officer of good enough. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about dumbing down the requirements for what our warfighters need. But when resources are constrained due to time, due to an operational threat that doesn't appear with regard to any schedule, you have to account for the appearance of a threat, the lack of further resources, and those are very difficult decisions.
So again, that's retired Vice Admiral David Vinlet, retired program manager for the F-35.
Yeah, he's passing on wisdom from several years of a really tough battle over this, so he knows of what he speaks.
Indeed. And I guess the final observation I'd make about this topic from this hearing last week, Emily, is, you know, when you have that capacity stored in the services and less in the joint community under the Secretary of Defense, you can have the opposite problem. Rather than having the services over-specify things, you can have an issue where the military really does need a joint capability and it doesn't get built because there's no constituency for it in the services. The example that came up several times was mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles. obstacles, MRAPs. Defense Secretary Bob Gates wrote about that extensively in his recent memoirs and said he basically had to drag the services kicking and screaming, and the only reason that program ever got done was because the secretary personally had his eyes and his full attention on it every single day. Otherwise, it just wouldn't have happened.